Thousands of books, articles, and newsletters have been written on selling over the last 100 years. But you can boil them all down to the basic 3 functions of selling. They are prospecting, presenting, and following up. In prospecting, you find people who can and will buy your product or service within a reasonable period of time. In presenting, you show the prospect that what you're selling is exactly what they need to satisfy their problem or fulfill their need in a cost-effective way at the present time. And in following up, you answer questions, overcome objections, remove obstacles, and get the sale. Prospecting, presenting, and following up. We call this the sales funnel or the sales hopper. You put prospects in the top of the hopper, and as they shake down, a certain number of prospects will yield a certain number of presentations, and a certain number of presentations will yield a certain number of follow-ups, with a certain number of follow-ups leading to a certain number of sales. Prospecting is where it starts. This is where you fill the pipeline or the hopper. It is prospecting that determines your ultimate success. It is strengths or weakness in prospecting that is the major determinant of success or failure in selling. You must prospect continuously. You must be good at prospecting, and you must continually keep a flow of new potential customers coming into your pipeline or flowing into your sales hopper. Now, with prospecting, with smaller sales, with smaller products and services, your success is determined by the quantity of prospects that you call on. Prospecting with smaller sales requires a high level of activity and efficiency. It requires good time management. It requires that you see a lot of people and cover a lot of ground and make a lot of presentations. It requires seeing as many potential customers as possible and using the law of averages. On the other hand, with larger sales, with bigger products, with more money involved, your success is usually determined by the quality of your sales work rather than by the frequency or efficiency of it. With larger sales, you require more careful planning and preparation. Just as you require greater efficiency with smaller sales, you require greater effectiveness with larger sales. Each potential customer is more valuable when you're selling larger products or services. You can't afford to lose a single customer. You can't afford to blow a sale by doing it improperly. And each part of the sale is more important, especially the later parts of the sale where you've already invested a good amount of time in getting to a certain point. You can take nothing for granted. As my friend Jim Rohn says with regard to business, casualness brings casualties. You can't be casual about large, important sales. Now, each typical prospect you meet is in one of 3 possible situations. The first situation is the prospect has a specific problem, and he or she knows exactly what it is, and you're there to help them solve that specific problem with your product or service. In the second possible situation, the prospect has a problem, but he or she is unclear about it. The customer has an area of uncertainty, of something unresolved. The customer knows that things could be better, that a problem exists, but he or she is not quite sure what the solution might be. And the third situation that a prospect will have is a problem that does not exist at all. The prospect may feel that he or she could be better off, but when you've done your research, you may find that what he or she is doing is the very best and most cost-efficient thing that he or she could be doing, and that he or she does not need your product or service at all. These are the 3. The customer has a clear specific problem, the customer has a vague and unclear problem, or the customer has no problem. Your job initially in prospecting is to find out which is which. Your job in prospecting is not to present, not to qualify, and not to sell. It is to act as a problem detective and look to see if a problem exists that your product or service can resolve in a cost-effective way. Now, when you meet prospects, they will be in one or more of the following situations. They will be initially uninterested. They'll even say, "I'm not interested." That's why we say use the instant reverse clause when someone says, "I'm not interested." You say, "Mr. Prospect, that's exactly why I'm calling." Or, "Mrs. Prospect, that's exactly why I'm calling you today." They'll say, "What?" You say, "Mr. Prospect, most of our very best customers were initially uninterested when we approached them for the first time, but after they learned what we were selling and how they could benefit, they became our best customers and they recommend us to others." Another situation that prospects will be in is that they are unaware of the benefits of your solution, or the benefits of your competitor's solution for that matter. And again, they will respond by saying, well, we're not in the market, we can't afford it, we're not interested, because they don't know how much better off they can be with your product or service, which probably represents an innovation or an improvement or change on what they're doing. Your prospects may be satisfied with their current situation, or with their current product, or their current supplier. They're in a comfort zone. They say things like, well, we're really not interested because we're perfectly satisfied with the company or person that we're dealing with right now. This is quite common. Your job is simply to get an audience and to suggest that there might be some way that you could offer them something that's different or better or cheaper than they're currently getting, and all you really want is a try or an opportunity in some small area. Prospects may be in a situation where they don't believe they have a need or a problem. Maybe they haven't given it very much thought. Maybe they have no idea of how much better off they could be. Because they don't believe they have a need or a problem that your product or service can satisfy or resolve, they'll again be uninterested and resistant and maybe even negative. Or they'll say they can't afford it. When they say they can't afford it, what they're saying is that they did not expect to spend this amount of money. You see, companies and individuals who have budgets and who plan for the future don't budget for unexpected or unusual products or services. When they say they can't afford it, what they're basically saying is that they have heard no reason as of yet to expand their budget or to substitute your expense for something else. Don't worry about it. Finally, most prospects that you'll meet will be busy, preoccupied, and overwhelmed with work and responsibilities. They'll often feel that they're too busy to even consider your offer. The basic rule is that good prospects are very busy and hard to get to, and poor prospects are not particularly busy and very easy to get to. The more busy and preoccupied they are, the more likely it is that they are the valuable kind of prospect that you want to work with and develop. In every one of these cases, your job is to smile, let these concerns and natural buyer resistance roll off your back like water off a duck's back, and keep on trucking. Prospecting begins with you thinking through your product benefits and your customer needs, thinking through how they can match. And here are the critical questions that you ask. First, what exactly do you sell in terms of your customer? What result do you sell? What does your product do for the customer that is not currently being done or being done as well? What specific benefits does your customer get that justifies the cost and effort of changing? What values do your products or service offer that your customer can most take advantage of? Here's another question. What is your unique selling proposition? We talked about that earlier. What is it in 12 words or less that your product or service has or does that makes it unique, different, and better than any other similar product or service in the market? What is your competitive advantage? What is your area of superiority? You see, the sale will come to hang on your ability to convince your customer that not only you have this competitive advantage, but that this competitive advantage should be the critical determinant of whether or not he or she buys from you. Who exactly, based on what we just talked about, is your ideal customer? Who is your ideal customer in terms of personality, occupation, lifestyle, position, function, age, education, level of financial resources? Sit down and imagine that you could define or describe your ideal customer and turn it over to a company that would then go out and generate lists of ideal customers for you to call on. Next question is, why does your ideal customer buy from you? What benefits does he or she seek? What primary benefits and what secondary benefits? In other words, why would he or she be in the market at all? A good way to answer this question is to ask, who is buying your product today? Who are your current customers? What demographics and qualifications do they have? How would you describe them? Why are they buying them today? Who has bought your products or services in the past, and why? Who is likely to be buying your products or services in the future? Once you've answered those questions, then you can ask, where is your customer? In what industries does your customer agglomerate? What companies can you find more of your customers? What departments in what companies? What functions or positions or professions or occupations? What age groups or neighborhoods or locations? Where exactly is your greatest customer concentration? Finally, how does your customer buy? What needs to happen before your customer makes a buying decision? For example, do you have to establish a high-quality relationship? Does the customer have to feel a high level of trust and confidence in you before he or she will buy? Will your customer buy only when he or she has heard by word of mouth from someone else who's bought? Does your customer have to get approval from someone? Does your customer have to go through a bidding process or an appraisal process or an evaluation process? Does your customer have a buying strategy by which he or she evaluates this kind of purchase? Think this through. Look at your experience. Talk to people around you. Even ask your customers what has to happen in their work and in their lives before they make a buying decision in the area of your product or service. Prospecting today is much easier if you have thought through the special benefits of your product and who can most use them. This saves you from wasting your time and running around like a chicken with its head cut off or like a dog chasing passing cars. You sit and think carefully and you analyze and assess the very best people to spend your time prospecting. Prospecting is also easier if you've built up your knowledge base and your personal database of prospective customers and prospective industries. And prospecting is also easier if you've positioned yourself as a consultant, as an advisor, as a profit or financial improvement specialist. Prospecting today means looking for ideal potential customers. Remember, there are millions and millions of people out there, and your job is to define and describe the ideal people that represent the highest return on time invested. Here are some of the characteristics of the best prospects in the market. First, they have specific problems that your product or service can solve. And they're clear about those problems. They know what they are. They recognize that they have a need for what you're offering. Second, they can be leveraged into additional sales if they're satisfied. If they buy one item from you and they like it, they can buy another and another and another. Third, there is a large potential sale possible if you're successful in convincing this prospect that you are offering the lowest risk, highest value, best choice product or service. In other words, it's worth your while because this customer can make a big purchase. Fourth, they're favorably disposed toward your industry, your company, your product, and of course yourself. In other words, they are impressed with your reputation, they like your image, They are moved by your testimonials. They are the result of referrals from other satisfied customers. They like you. They like what you stand for. They're not negative, hostile, suspicious, challenging, critical, or anything else. And if you're in sales, you know what this type of person is like. The fifth characteristic of the best prospects is that their company is growing or that they as individuals are prosperous. They're doing well. They're fully employed. If they're a company, they're expanding and increasing market share. This means that they can usually buy quickly and pay immediately. Remember, one of the characteristics of a good prospect is that they can pay for the product or service in a timely fashion. One of the funniest things you hear salespeople say is they say, "Boy, I've got a real good prospect. He just doesn't have any money." No, this is not a real good prospect. This is just somebody who's maybe enjoyable to talk to, but they're not a prospect unless they can pay you in a timely fashion. A sixth characteristic of good prospects is they are good sources of credibility and referrals. When people hear that you sold to them, they'll be impressed and they'll be open to buying themselves. If they give you a referral to someone else, the person they give you the referral to is impressed by that person to the point where they'll listen to you and take your offering seriously. And especially the bottom line of a good prospect is that they represent a good investment of your time, a good investment of your life, a very high potential return on your energy spent to get the sale. There are four parts to the process of prospecting. The first is the goal. The goal is to get to the person, find the person with the problem. This is called the problem haver. This is the person with the dissatisfaction or the need. This is the person who wants and needs and is willing to pay for the solution that you offer. The second part of the process of prospecting is to prospect indirectly, to call someone else in another department to get advice or opinion or help, to get guidance and leadership in how to penetrate this account. One of the recommendations I give to salespeople is to call the company and ask for the top salesperson in the company. Speak to the top salesperson and tell them that you're a salesperson as well, and you'd like to approach this company with your product or service, and you'd like to talk to somebody and sort of get some ideas and input and advice on what the next logical step would be and who you might approach to actually make the sale. What I found is that salespeople will always help other salespeople. If you call and ask for a salesperson, they'll give you advice and turn it around. If possible, open the door for that salesperson as well. The third part of the process of prospecting is to look for a coach. Look for a mentor, a champion within the client company. Look for someone who can help you in the customer account. We call this pull-through selling, where there is somebody in the company who will guide you and show you the ropes. This is a person who wants to help you to make the sale. In fact, Miller and Heinemann, in the work that they've done in sales, recommend that you not even try to make a sale until you find someone in the company who will help you and who wants you to be successful and who will guide you to the right person at the right time and give you the right information. The fourth part of the process of prospecting is to remember to always start with an interview. Make no attempt to sell and just focus on building trust with a person somewhere in the company. Remember getting in the door of the company, sitting down and talking to someone, even in a completely separate department from where you want to actually make the sale, is the thin end of the wedge. It gets your foot in the door. It gives you an opportunity to demonstrate the quality of person you are, and then to leverage off of that person and get introductions to other people who are closer and closer to the decision maker. When you sit down with a person somewhere in the company, explain your business, what you do, what your products or services are, and then simply ask for his or her opinion. Ask for his or her advice or observations on your product or service. Often people will respond negatively because they think you're trying to set them up for a sale. When they do and they say, well, I don't think we'd be interested, or they're quite happy with what they're doing right now, or whatever, you say, well, tell me more about that. When they say that they've got something that they like already, you say, well, for example. These two expressions, for example and tell me more, enable you to avoid being defensive, to avoid selling or presenting or defending or explaining your product or service. Just be relaxed, easygoing, cheerful. Make no effort to sell. Just ask questions, listen intently, nod, smile, and concentrate on building trust. When you eventually get face-to-face with the problem haver, the person who needs your solution, you do three things. First, position yourself as a consultant seeking a problem to solve. Take a very low-key, low-pressure, no-pressure approach. In fact, in the initial meeting, I advise that you don't even bring your briefcase or a writing pad into the meeting. Go in with your hands empty. This will cause the prospect to relax considerably because he or she doesn't feel that he or she is about to be ambushed by your whipping your briefcase open and hitting them with brochures and price lists all over their desk, as the mediocre salespeople do. The second thing to do when you get face-to-face with the problem haver is to position yourself as a partner seeking an alliance. You can say, Mr. Prospect, we like to enter into long-term alliances with our customers. We look upon your problems as our problems, and we want to be in business with you for a long time. So when we ask you questions, we're really looking down the road to next year and the year after, and we're looking for ways that we can work together to mutual benefit. The third thing that you do is to focus on the relationship. Focus on building trust. And the key to building trust is to ask good questions and listen carefully and attentively to the answers. The way that you ask good questions is simple. Is you plan your questions in advance. You don't walk in like most salespeople thinking, I can hardly wait to hear what I have to say next. you come in with a list of questions, preferably a typed list, and you give a copy to your customer and you say, "Mr. Prospect, these are some of the questions that I'd like to go over with you in the time that we have today." Make the questions very general to start with, and then move progressively through the process. Now, you build trust, rapport, credibility, and professional image in the initial prospecting meeting with two specific types of questions. The first of these two types of questions are personal questions. They're aimed at the individual and his or her interests and background and opinions. You want to build a bridge with the prospect. You want to find out a little bit about him or her as a human being. In fact, it's almost impossible for you to sell without developing a common interest or a common bond, finding something that the two of you know or enjoy or have in your common backgrounds. The second type of questions you need to ask to establish a relationship and build a professional image are situation questions. These are aimed at the problem area for which your product is a solution. These are questions like, what are you doing in this area right now? How is that working for you? Are you satisfied with the way it is now? What if you could improve your efficiency in that area by 20%? If we could show you a much better way to get the same thing done at the same or lower cost, would you be interested? Now, these are situation questions, and here's the critical point. Almost all sales training over the last 50 to 100 years has been aimed at personal questions, asking the customer personal things about his or her life and family and home and job and cars and favorite football team and where they went to school and so on. The tragedy today is that it's easy to ask personal questions in selling, and it's easy for the prospect to answer them. However, they're like puffed wheat. They have no food value. They have no nutritional value for the customer, so that he or she may enjoy talking to you for 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 minutes and talking to you all about his various situations in his or her life. But when your time is up, the customer will not see you again. We joke in our seminars and we say that the customer will then go into a 3-year meeting. What is a 3-year meeting? You know very well what a 3-year meeting is. You've been calling the prospect for 3 years trying to set up another appointment, and he or she is still in a meeting. The fact is that because the customer got no value out of the meeting with you, he or she is too busy to sit down with you and have another useless 30 or 60 minutes of aimless and empty questions. That's why the proper ratio of situation to personal questions is 2-to-1. You have to ask 2 situation questions focused on the customer's problem or situation for every 1 question you ask about the customer's personal life and business. If you ask too many personal questions, it may be an enjoyable conversation, but it will very likely kill any possibilities you have of proceeding in the account. And the final point in your initial meeting is that you must be able to suggest that you have a solution to a specific problem in the first interview, or you're out at first base. The customer will simply be too busy to see you again unless he or she has a very strong feeling that you have something of value to share with him or her at the next meeting. When you go through the first meeting, your job is to end the meeting with a statement such as, "I believe that we have some things, services, proposals, ideas that can be very valuable to you and that can help you increase your profitability, cut your costs, improve your efficiency, and so on, whatever it happens to be, and I'd like to get together with you again at another time to go over a couple of proposals in this area. Would that be all right?" In other words, never leave the first meeting hanging, or you'll very likely never get the second meeting. In prospecting, there are several key points that you must always keep in mind. You need specific objectives for each call, especially in the initial stages of prospecting. Your aim is to move the sale forward toward a conclusion. So when you prospect, you want, first of all, to see a specific person. Second, you want to get specific information. Third, you want to determine if a problem exists at all and if a sale is possible. And fourth, you want to move to the next logical step in the sales process. When you go in, be very clear that these are the bases that you want to cover before you leave. Be willing to trade information on your prospecting call. Give in order to get. Tell the prospect what you found out about the industry and about the company. Tell the prospect some of the problems that other companies in this industry are having that he or she might be having, and tell the prospect some of the ideas that you've come up with that might be of help to this particular prospect. Explain to the prospect what additional information you need from him in order to be more specific about the kind of recommendations or solutions that you can make. Be sure to say, "Mr. Prospect, please understand, I'm not here to sell you anything. That is not my purpose in this call. I don't even know if what we're doing and what you're doing are compatible." Fourth, assume skepticism, suspicion, and minimal interest on the part of the prospect. Assume a very high level of buyer's resistance. Assume that this prospect has been misled, lied to, cheated, and been sold a bill of goods many times before. Your job is to overcome that skepticism by being positive, relaxed, and cheerful. Be willing to spend and invest time with the prospect if he requires it. Remember, an investment of time builds credibility. Time is the essential factor in building relationships. The more time that you are willing to put in, and that you've put in already, the more the prospect will be willing to trust you and believe in you and be open to your recommendations. Finally, your prospecting call is successful if you uncover a specific problem you can solve, if you lay the foundation of a high-quality relationship, and if you get agreement to proceed to the next logical step, what I call the TDPPR. T stands for time, D stands for date, P stands for person, P stands for place, and R stands for reason. TDPPR. When you leave a call, you know that you are on the field and that you're still in the game when you leave with a time, a date, a person, a place, and a reason for the next call. Many salespeople come back to the office and their manager says, "Well, how's the sale going?" And they say, "It's going great." And then the sales manager says, "Well, what is the time, date, person, place, and reason for your next call or visit on that prospect?" And they have no answer. So, don't put it off. When you leave after the first call, don't say, "Well, I'll call you and we'll set up a time and we'll get together." Pull out your book and say, "Mr. Prospect, if you have your calendar handy now, why don't we set a specific time and date and arrange for the people to be in the meeting at the particular place for a particular reason? And if we have to change it in the future, we'll do it at that time. What do you say?" Keep the initiative and keep control of the conversation. The ball is in play, and it is your job now to move it down the field. Remember, in prospecting, your initial job is to make a friend, to uncover a problem or need, suggest a solution, and agree to continue the process at a specific time later. Success in selling comes from having all the prospects that you can possibly call on. Success in selling comes from having A prospects, B prospects, and C prospects. High quality, medium quality, and low prospects from having more prospects than you can call on at any given time, so that you have to carefully plan and organize your time allocation so that you're calling on those who are of the greatest value at the present moment. By filling the front end of your sales pipeline with prospects, you virtually guarantee that out of the other end will come all the sales and income that you desire. One of the most important laws in all of human development and metaphysics is the law of correspondence. This law says that as within, so without. It says that your outer results and rewards are a result of your inner development, your inner work, and your inner preparation. In this session, we're going to talk about personal performance. We're going to talk about being the best in your field. And we begin with the fact that life is a do-it-to-yourself project. But in this project, there are no limits. You can become anything that you want to become if you want it long enough and hard enough. The only real limits on what you can achieve with your life are the limits that you allow to be imposed on your own thinking. If you look around you, you will find that there are men and women with limited talents, limited intelligence, limited abilities, even people from foreign countries with no language skills, who have done wonderful things with their lives, and so can you. Most of the limits that we set on our own minds are imposed on us from without, but they do not exist in reality. You see, you are born with certain talents and abilities. It's your basic constitutional, genetic, intellectual makeup. It's like being dealt a hand of cards. It's what you do with them that counts. It's not what the cards are, it's how you play them day to day, week to week, month to month. When you're growing up, you learn various subjects. As you learn these subjects, you will find some things that you're interested in and that you're good at. You'll find others that repel you and that have no interest for you at all. These are indications of where your future talents and abilities might lie. Most people between the ages of 7 and 14 find themselves drawn to certain activities and interests. When they're 35 and 40, they find, if they're successful, that those were the indicators of what they're doing as adults. As you mature, you develop certain skills and competencies. And this is really the key. It is to take everything that you are innately and then develop it so that you can do certain things with extraordinary ability. As I said earlier, the future belongs to the competent. And today, unless you're very competent at what you do, you have no future. A commitment to excellence in your field is absolutely essential if you want to be happy, successful, and fulfilled as a human being. Anything else than a commitment to excellence is an acceptance of mediocrity. Things are changing so rapidly, knowledge and skills and abilities are becoming obsolete so quickly, that if you're not continually getting better, you're actually getting worse. Nobody is improving by just standing there. You've got to be growing all the time just to stay ahead of the curve, just to stop from slipping backwards. When you become excellent, you develop the ability to make all the sales possible for you. There's nothing worse than working hard, 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 and losing a sale because of one small talent or skill that you neglected to develop in your repertoire. When you become excellent, you can make the kind of money that you're capable of. I have worked with thousands of men and women in every conceivable industry who have taken my materials and sales training programs and have doubled and tripled and increased their income 5 times in as little as 30, 60, and 90 days by simply upgrading their skills and becoming better at what they do. Becoming excellent enables you to fulfill your complete potential as a person, and it's only possible when you become really good at what you do. Interestingly enough, each person deep down inside has an internal drive to be all they're capable of becoming, and you'll never be really happy unless you fulfill that drive by becoming really good at something that you enjoy and something that's important to you. Here's a fact that many people don't like to hear. It's that you are earning today exactly what you're worth today, no more and no less. In fact, the amount that you're earning today is the amount that you have decided to earn today. Nobody else imposed your income on you. Your income today is the sum total result of all the choices and decisions that you've made over your entire life toward developing your capacity to earn money. So what you're earning now is a result of all your previous choices. If you want to earn more sometime in the future, well, then it's up to you to go to work to develop the capacity to do so. The iron laws of human destiny are the laws of cause and effect, sowing and reaping, action and reaction. You get out what you put in, no more and no less. Our marketplace today only pays excellent rewards for excellent performance. It pays average rewards for average performance or average contribution, and it pays below average rewards and unemployment, insecurity, frustration, and unhappiness for below-average performance. Your job is to get up into the top 10% where you perform at an outstanding level in everything you do. Your job is to be the best in your field of professional selling, to join the very top ranks of salespeople in your industry. This is so important that the achievement of it will enable you to achieve almost every other material goal you have. So be willing to pay any price. Be willing to put in any amount of time, any amount of money, any amount of effort, overcome any obstacle. It doesn't matter, but by gum, be the very best at what you do. It may take you a week, a month, a year, or 5 years, but remember, excellence is a journey, not a destination. And happiness is the progressive realization of a worthy ideal. Happiness means moving step by step toward becoming something that's important to you. And every step you take on your journey toward excellence makes you feel happy and more fulfilled and more competent and more in control of your destiny. In achieving excellence, never forget that you get better one step at a time, like climbing a mountain. You don't try to change the whole world at once. You take a hold of one area, one weakness, and you go to work in that area. And when you master it, you go to the second step and the third step and so on. In no time at all, you'll be at the top of the mountain. Robert Schuller once said, "By the yard, it's hard, but inch by inch, anything's a cinch." You've got to get in for the long haul. You've got to look at your profession as if you're going to be in it for a minimum of 5 years and decide that if I'm going to be in professional selling, doggone it, I'm going to be one of the very best that there is in this industry. I am going to throw my whole heart into what I'm doing. And then start in the area that can help you the most. Start in the area where improvement in your performance will give you the most immediate results. This brings us back to what we talked about earlier as critical success factors of your job. These are the things you do that determine your success or failure. These are also the things that you neglect to do or do poorly that determine your frustration and underachievement. Even one weakness, one poor level of performance in a critical success factor of your job can be enough to hold you back. It can be enough to trip you out and to cause you to quit selling. Here's some possible critical success factors in selling. The first, of course, is prospecting and getting appointments. It's the number one reason why people fail is because they never get over their fear long enough to develop skill in this area. Another critical success factor is developing and building industry and customer knowledge, which, as you know, requires tremendous self-discipline and a lot of time and effort, many hours after work and on weekends, really learning your business from the inside out. Many people fail because they never take the time to do this. Many people succeed because they become experts in this area. Another critical success factor in selling is establishing rapport and credibility. It's being the kind of person that other people like. It's building trust. It's asking good questions and forming good relationships and making a good first impression on the prospect or customer. Another critical success factor is personal health and image and personality. I've met many salespeople who, simply as the result of the way they looked and the way they dressed, made an immediate, positive, powerful first impression on their prospects and opened the door, build their credibility, and opened their prospects' minds to talking to them. I've also met too many salespeople who give no thought to the way they look, and within 4 seconds, according to the research, the prospect has decided that he or she will not buy or deal with this particular person. Another critical success factor is identifying the correct problem or need that the customer has. Being able to be a good diagnostician, to diagnose correctly exactly where the customer is coming from, is a real skill in selling. A further critical success factor is industry specialization. Again, we find over and over that the highest paid salespeople are those who have specialized in a particular industry and become extremely knowledgeable about how their product or service can be applied in that industry to bring about immediate measurable results. A critical success factor is presenting your product as the best possible solution. Many people get all the way to the presentation and then fall apart. Others become extremely good at presenting their product very skillfully, diagrammatically, using graphs and charts and good questions and active listening. And as a result, people get excited and motivated and interested in the product in the course of the presentation. Here's a critical success factor. It's selling against competition. What do you do when you go up against two or three determined competitors, all of whom want the business, all of whom have met with the customer and built trust and rapport and made presentations and shown the customer that their product or service is better than yours? Your ability to sell against your competition, to identify their weak spots, to maximize their vulnerabilities, and to minimize your own is a key skill in successful selling. Another critical success factor is the way you answer customer concerns and objections, the way you deal with customer resistance, the effectiveness and intelligence with which you answer the customer's problems and overcome them so the customer feels no resistance in proceeding. Another critical success factor is getting the customer to take action. It's overcoming buyer resistance and getting the customer to make a commitment to making the purchase. A critical success factor is follow-up. It's the implementation. It's the successful installation of the sale. It's taking care of the customer and exceeding expectations so the customer is open to doing business with you again and recommending you to his or her friends. Personal management skills, personal efficiency, time management, personal organization are also critical success factors. Finally, the last critical success factor that can make or break you in sales is your ability to get resales and referrals from your customers. If you're really good, after you've been in the business for a year or two, all your business should be with existing customers and with referrals from those existing customers to new customers. Give yourself a score of 1 to 10 in each of these areas: prospecting and getting appointments, building industry and customer knowledge, establishing rapport and credibility. Where do you score in 1 to 10, with 1 being low and 10 being high? In personal health and image and personality, in identifying the correct problem or need, in industry specialization rather than generalization, in product presentation, where would you give yourself a score? In selling against competition, in answering customer concerns and objections, in getting the customer to take action, closing the sale, in implementation, installation, exceeding expectations with your customer, in personal management skills, especially time management, and in getting resales and referrals. On a score of 1 to 10, how do you do in each of those areas? Well, if you're perfectly honest with yourself, you'll recognize that in at least one of those areas, you're probably at a 2 or a 3 out of a possible of 10. In many of those areas, you're at an 8 or a 9. But wherever you're weak, that's where you have to go to work. Once you've identified your critical success factors and scored yourself, share the score with your manager and get his or her opinion. Share the score with your friends and your colleagues. Share the score with your spouse. Even share the score with one of your best customers who you like and trust and who will be honest with you. It's very, very important that you do not fool yourself when it comes to analyzing your performance. Your job is to be a champion, like a champion athlete, and you can only become a champion by getting feedback on your performance and then by working on your areas of weakness. These scores, by the way, are nothing to be embarrassed about. Everybody is good, medium, and bad at something. They're simply a baseline. They give you a foundation on which you can begin to build and compare your performance against. Now, within each critical success factor, there are also as many as 5 to 7 smaller critical success factors. The more you break your work down into small, discrete components and analyze your performance in each particular area, the more likely it is that you're going to become very, very good at the total profession of selling. In prospecting, for example, there are 7 critical success factors. They are identifying suspects initially. They're qualifying suspects to identify the prospects among them. They are telephone skills and the way you use the telephone. There is getting appointments with prospects once you identified who they are. They may be getting past the gatekeeper. How do you get past the secretary or the receptionist to talk to the person? How do you get past the voicemail machine? This is a real skill that can make or break you in prospecting. Once you get to talk to the right people, getting them to consider you as an alternative to their existing supplier is also a critical success factor in prospecting. And finally, getting follow-up meetings after the first call, getting back to see the prospect, to pursue the sale, to develop the account, is a critical success factor. Sometimes, for example, you can be poor in just one thing, that's telephone skills. And because you're poor in telephone skills, your whole house of cards of prospecting collapses. You achieve superb sales performance by breaking everything down into individual tasks and then analyzing each of the tasks carefully. Once you've done that, you identify your weakest important area. Your weakest important area, just like with a company, sets the height of what you can do with all your other talents and skills. It is your most vital critical success factor. It is absolutely essential that you get good in the area that's holding you back the most. This is where you must begin. Resolve to become excellent in that particular area, and sometimes it will bring up all of your other sales activities altogether. Sometimes just becoming really good at using the telephone to get appointments will double and triple your sales in a very short period of time. We talked earlier about the limiting step concept, or the theory of constraints as it applies to companies. The theory of constraint says that there is one activity in your sales activities that sets the speed at which you achieve your sales goals. This is the choke point. This is your bottleneck. This is the limiting step within your job overall. So you have to stand back and you have to ask yourself this question. I could make all the sales I wanted to make, if only. And then fill in the blank. I could double my sales in the next 90 days, if only. And then complete the sentence. What is your limiting step? If you're not sure about what it is, ask your manager. Ask your friends. Ask your spouse. You see, every one of us lives in a fishbowl for everyone else. And other people can see what's holding us back, even if in many cases we can't see ourselves. There is a limiting step within each critical success factor. Look into your critical success factors for your particular sales industry, for your particular job, and ask yourself within each one, what is the part of it that is the constraint, that's the choke point, that's setting the speed at which you succeed in that area? Once you get into the habit of identifying limiting steps or constraints, you'll find that there are these bottlenecks and limiting steps on your activities every day and every hour. Great success, greater personal effectiveness comes from being alert and aware to them, from identifying them in everything you do and then eliminating them. When you get up in the morning, you say, what is the constraint or limiting step that determines how fast I see my first customer? What is the constraint that determines how quickly I get to the office? What is the constraint that determines how rapidly I call back or see another prospect or customer? Keep asking yourself and looking at what's holding you back. Be honest, be objective, ask others, get feedback from others so that you know the things that you're doing or not doing that are determining your success or lack of success. Being the best, achieving excellence in each area of skill and ability, requires clear income and sales goals broken down by year, month, week, and day, and even broken down by the hour. When you have clear goals, they act as motivators to self-improvement. We said earlier that you are teleological. Every act you take is to relieve a dissatisfaction, or every act you take is to improve your condition in some way. If you have very clear, well-defined written sales goals that you want to accomplish in a month, 3 months, 6 months, or 12-month period, you will have an internal drive to improving yourself and developing your abilities to achieve those goals. So, with your annual income goal, and by the way, all top salespeople have very clear goals for how much they want to earn each year. Let's say that you want to earn $50,000 a year. For some of you, that will be an improvement over your current income. For others, that would be a step backward. But bear with me, and let's use $50,000 as an example. Let's also imagine that you work on straight commission and that you get 5% commission on sales. Well, if your annual income goal was $50,000 and you get 5% commission on sales, it means that your annual sales goal would be $1 million. These are your two base numbers. How much you want to earn, and how much you have to sell of your various products and services in order to achieve that amount. Then, you break the annual income goal and annual sales goal down by how much you want to earn and how much you have to sell per month, how much you have to earn and sell per week, per day, and per hour. For the sake of simplicity, let's imagine that $50,000 is your goal, and you divide it by the number of days you work each year, which is approximately 250 days. This means that your daily goal would be $200 per day. If you divide $200 per day by the 8 hours that you usually work, that would be $25 per hour. Now you have an organizing principle. Now you have a focus. From this moment, work only at $25 per hour tasks. Work all the time you work. Work at doing only those things that your company can afford to pay you $25 or more per hour at. And what is it that you get paid for? What pays $25 per hour or more? It is prospecting, presenting, and following up. It is getting face-to-face with qualified prospects who can and will buy and pay for the product within a reasonable period of time. Everything else is warming up and warming down. In fact, every salesperson wakes up unemployed every morning and remains unemployed until he or she gets face-to-face with a qualified prospect. The average salesperson in America, according to Columbia University and many other surveys, works 20% of the time, about 1.5 hours per day. That means that they are face-to-face with qualified prospects approximately 1.5 hours per day, on average. If you want to increase your income, you must increase the amount of time that you spend face-to-face with qualified prospects. I'm convinced that if you use a stopwatch and measure the number of minutes that you spend with customers, just increasing the number of minutes will increase your sales and increase your income, all other things held constant. With regard to your $25 per hour target, every minute of every day, you must ask yourself, would you pay someone else $25 an hour to do what you're doing right now? Would you pay somebody else $25 an hour to drive around listening to the radio? Would you pay them $25 an hour to talk on the phone with your family or friends? Would you pay them $25 an hour to read the newspaper or drink coffee or make photocopies or shuffle business cards? Whatever it is, if you would not take $25 per hour out of your pocket and pay somebody else to do it, stop doing it immediately and get on to doing things that pay $25 per hour. The most important word that you can learn in increasing your income is the word no to all low-value, low-contribution tasks and activities. Whenever something comes up that does not pay $25 an hour, say no to that activity and get on doing the things that pay the kind of money that you and your family want to earn. Once you have your sales and income goals, you define them and break them down into the activities that you must engage in to achieve them. You see, activities are controllable, but sales are not. You never know where your next sale is going to come from. You never know if you're going to lose a sale after having worked on it for weeks and months. But you do know that by the law of averages and the law of probabilities, if you do a certain number of things in a certain way over and over again, you must ultimately achieve a certain level of sales, even though you can't be sure of exactly where they'll come from. So break your goals down into the activities such as calls and appointments. How many calls must you make? How many appointments must you get in order to keep your pipeline filled? How many presentations and proposals must come out of those calls and appointments in order for you to be busy all the time? What is your ratio of calls to appointments? I've worked with many salespeople who have taken their ratio from 20 to 1 to 15 to 1 to 10 to 1 to 5 to 1 to 3 to 1 in as little as a single year, and as you can tell, have increased their sales 7 times as a result. How many times must you follow up with a presentation to make an eventual sale? What is your ratio from the beginning of your calls and appointments to the end of your sales? Keep accurate records of your activities and calculate the averages. What is the average size of your sale? What is the average income that you make from the sale? Divide that by the number of calls you have to make an average sale to work out what is your average income per call. Play the averages. Play the probabilities. They'll never let you down, and they'll never do you wrong. To manage your time the very best way possible, you must plan every day and every week in advance. Plan each week the week before. Top salespeople take time each Saturday or Sunday to lay out a blueprint for the coming week. Best of all is to plan each month the month before, and then plan the weeks generally and tighten them up as you move toward them. Plan each day the evening before. The last thing you do before you quit is you make out a list of everything you have to do the coming day, organize it by priority, and schedule it, and then put your book away, close the door, and turn off the lights. It's one of the greatest cures for insomnia that there is planning your whole day before you fall off to sleep. Tight time planning goes hand in hand with high income. Allocate your time in 15-minute blocks. You will find that people who plan their time the tightest, who know where they will be exactly at 3 o'clock on Thursday afternoon 2 weeks from today, are people who are making the most money. The way you organize each day is to make a list of everything that you have to do, everything that you can possibly think of. Once you have the list, set clear priorities on your tasks. Determine what is more important and what is less important. And the way you determine what is more important, what is a high priority, is by measuring consequences. The consequences of a behavior are the real measure of whether it's a high or low priority. If it has high positive or negative consequences, it's important. If it has low consequences or no consequences, it's not important at all. Use the ABCDE method with your list every day before you start work. Resist the temptation to start work without a list, and resist the temptation to start work without analyzing your list in advance. The ABCDE method stands for this. An A task is a must do. This is something for which there are serious consequences. These are the most important things that you have to get done this day, this week, and this month. A B task is something that you should do. This is something that has mild consequences if you do it or don't do it. Somebody may be inconvenienced or unhappy, but it's not as important as an A. By the way, you should never do a B when you have an A left undone. Always do your A tasks first. If you have several A tasks, then you organize them in order of priority with A1, A2, A3, and so on. This is the greatest of all time management techniques. A C task is something that is nice to do, but it's something that has no consequences whether you do it or not. Whether you drop off your laundry, pick up your dry cleaning, phone your friend on the phone, it's something that would be nice to do, but whether you do it or not doesn't matter at all to your career. A D task is something that you delegate, and the rule is to delegate everything you possibly can that someone else can do below your desired hourly rate of $25 or more per hour. Delegation is the way that you get leverage in your life. It's the way you multiply yourself. It's the way you expand your capacity from what you can do to what you can control. All highly paid men and women are excellent at delegating low-value tasks. And finally, E stands for eliminate. And you should eliminate all activities that are of lower value than more important activities that can contribute more to your life. One of the most important rules in personal management is that setting priorities, the things you're going to do first, means setting posteriorities as well. And these are the things that you're going to do last or discontinue altogether. The rule is that before you can start something new, you must stop something old. You don't have any spare time, so you can't do something else unless you stop doing something simultaneously. Getting in means getting out. Picking up means letting go. Starting up something that is more important means discontinuing something that is less important. In fact, setting your posteriorities carefully and one by one eliminating things that no longer make an important contribution to your life is the key to freeing up more time for you to achieve more goals that will give you greater rewards and satisfaction. And without doing it, nothing is possible. Once you've organized your work and your tasks by priority, concentrate single-mindedly on one thing the most important thing and stay at it until it's 100% complete. In all the years of studying success, I have found that every successful man or woman has developed the ability to concentrate on one thing and to stay at it until it's done. Unsuccessful men and women have lost the ability or never developed the ability to concentrate and stay at something, the most important thing, until it's complete. It requires tremendous willpower and self-discipline, but it is the key to great success in every area of life. To keep yourself on track, ask these questions continually. First, what is the most valuable use of my time right now? Ask this question over and over and over again until it hums, until it's programmed into your subconscious mind. What is the most valuable use of your time right now? And whatever the answer is to that question, every minute, every hour, do only that until it's done completely and done well. And second, ask, is what I'm doing right now leading to a sale? Is what I'm doing right now leading to a sale? Is what I'm doing right now making me better, improving my performance, getting me appointments, opening doors, increasing my knowledge and skill, and leading me to a sale? And if it's not leading to a sale, whatever it is, if it's not leading you to a sale, stop doing it right now and start prospecting, presenting, or following up. After every call you make, successful or unsuccessful, ask these two magic questions for personal improvement. Magic question number one is, what did I do right in that call? If possible, write down everything that you can think of that you did right. Even if a call is a complete disaster, you did some things right that you should repeat later on. The second magic question is, what would I do differently if I had that call to make over again? If it was a successful call, analyze it and extract every positive lesson you can learn by saying, what was it that I did that I should do in subsequent sales? If it was unsuccessful, say, how could I improve it next time? These two questions, what did I do right, and what would I do differently, are two of the most powerful questions in all of self-development. You can apply them to every area of life, and especially professional selling. The answers to both questions are positive. The answers to both questions force you to review your own performance with a view to making it better next time. And asking and answering these questions programs the answers into your subconscious and predisposes you to doing better the next time you get a chance. Continually increase your competence in your key result areas, in your critical success factors. One of the most important of all time management techniques is to get better at what you do most of the time. Get better at the most important things you do that determine your income. Get better at the areas where you're weak. Get better at the areas that are constraints on your success. Finally, set high standards for yourself and commit every day to being the best. Commit to getting better every day, every week, every month. Remember, nothing can stop you from being a member of the top 10% of your field if you persist long enough and hard enough. If you keep on keeping on, you must ultimately move to the top and enjoy all the rewards of the high performers.